Introduction to the book of Isaiah. We have a lot of ground to cover because, Lord willing, I want to be able to start into the text at our next session, but we do have a lot to digest today. So hang on to your hat. Maybe some places where we've been doing some highlighting and not anything in detail. Now remember, come Tuesday, that's September the 5th, you have a memory verse. I'm not going to remind you from here on out. You have a memory verse that will be due. You will write that out. They're printed in the syllabus. Remember, you're to memorize them as word for word as they are printed out in the syllabus. You also have a quiz based on your homework that is due also on September the 5th, based on the reading connected with your homework. Does everybody understand? Anybody doesn't understand that? Let's get off to a good start. I hate to see people dig a hole and fall into it and then have 15 weeks to try to climb out. Okay, today we want to start with point two in the introduction to Isaiah. Isaiah, the man and the prophet. What does his name mean? Names mean things. Bible people gave names to their children that encapsulated their faith. That was referred to some crisis that had happened. Their names meant, we don't do that in Western culture. We tend to hear a name on a soap opera that we like or in a movie, and that's what we name our kids. But biblical people actually created names, and names in the Bible are actually sentences that are put in sort of condensed form. So Isaiah's name, that I-A-H on the end of Isaiah, that is an abbreviation of the name of God, abbreviation of Yahweh. And the first part of his name, starting with I, is from the Hebrew word Yashah, the Hebrew root Yashah, which means to save. So you put it all together and it comes out something like Yahweh saves, or help of Yahweh, salvation of Yahweh. You could actually translate it different ways, but Yahweh is salvation is the way it is generally translated. So we want to remember the meaning of Isaiah's name. Now in terms of his parentage, his father's name is given in the text in the first verse. His name was Amoz, not to be confused with the prophet Amos. Different spelling. In Hebrew, the spelling is even more pronounced than it is in the difference in the spelling is even more pronounced than it is in the English. Some of the church fathers were so stupid about Hebrew, they got the two mixed up. But his father's name, interestingly enough, may have turned up on a recent inscription that was found. It was published, well, it's not so recent now, back in 1960. They found a seal. Now, you know, in Bible days, they didn't sign documents. They sealed them with a wax seal. Most people couldn't write. And so they would have a seal that they would put into the clay or that they could put in ink and put onto the papyrus document. Or sometimes just the seal itself was appended like a wax substance to a document. And each seal had the name of the owner of the seal. So you wore your seal around your neck, much like, well, I used to wear my memory stick around my neck. It's in my computer right now. And so they wear their seal around their neck or maybe on a ring. And when they wanted to do legal documents, they could stamp them. Now, we have found a seal dating to this period. And it says, Amoz the scribe. Now, since we know that Isaiah also was a scribe, we'll learn that a little bit later, and since the scribal function stayed within families, I'd say probably a 75% chance that this is the seal of Isaiah's father that has actually come to life. It can't be 100% sure, but it's from the same time frame and from the same occupational group and from the same location, Jerusalem. So I thought you might find that interesting. Now there's a tradition that Isaiah was from the tribe of Judah, my estimation, a correct tradition, and that he was probably of royal blood. I don't know about that, but nonetheless, that's the tradition about Isaiah. He was born into the royal family. Now judging by the length of his ministry, and that's all we have to go by, we don't have any document anywhere, any verse that says Isaiah was born such and such a year. Judging by the length of his ministry, which we can roughly compute, I would say that Isaiah was born somewhere around about 765 before Christ. Now that would be the middle of the reign of the great king Uzziah, one of the greatest of the kings in the divided monarchy period. He was born during a period of tremendous prosperity. As I explained to you in our last session, the country was expanding, the rich were getting richer. It was a heyday period in the divided monarchy. Now his family, he was married. Some of the prophets were married, some were not. Jeremiah was forbidden to marry. Hosea was married, wife left him. Isaiah was married. Some of the other prophets, we don't know whether they were married or not. It all depended on the circumstances. And there are reasons why God told Jeremiah not to marry. In other cases, the prophets were married. So in this case, we know he was married. His wife is mentioned in chapter 8 and verse 3, which we'll get to later. And she's called the prophetess. We don't know her name. But her position, I presume that she is called the prophetess because she was married to the prophet. Now there are some who think that maybe she had the gift of prophecy as well, which isn't totally off the wall. But I think, if you want my opinion for what it's worth, and I guess that's what you paid to get when you signed up for the class, for what it's worth, in my opinion, she's called the prophetess because she's married to the prophet. Now, how many of you can think, who can think of other women in the Bible who were called specifically prophetesses? It's not a common occurrence in Bible history to find a prophetess. Can anybody think of some women in the Bible called prophetesses? Yes. Deborah is called a prophetess. That is correct. She's not the first, however. There's one before Deborah. Can anybody think who that might have been? Miriam, the sister of Moses. Anybody think of any other prophetesses in the Bible? There's one in the New Testament. Yes. Yes, there was. And her name was probably the least well-known of the ones we were going to name. Her name was Huldah, H-U-L-D-A-H. H-U-L-D-A-H. And she was in the time of Jeremiah, as Josh said. Don't know much about her, but she was apparently quite prominent. And in the New Testament, we have Anna, who uttered some words, prophetic words, at the time the Christ child was brought to the temple. And Philip had some daughters who prophesied. Now, they're not called prophetesses, but they are said to have prophesied, so I guess that would perhaps make them prophetesses. So that's the total list in the Bible of women who are called prophetesses. And Isaiah's wife is numbered in that short list. Now, he had two sons in his family. You're going to need to know their names. And I understand there's a spelling problem here. First is Shear Jashub. And you need to know not only the name, but what it means. Because these names are symbolic. Isaiah gave to his sons, this is something, by the way, that several of the prophets did, Hosea did to his children, gave them symbolic names. And so there is a prophecy encapsulated in the name of these two sons. And you'll see that when we get to it in a sec, but I just wanted to learn it up front, that he had two sons. Shear Jashub means a remnant shall return. Is that good or bad? A remnant shall return. Would you interpret that as good or bad? What about it? Is it hopeful or discouraged?
It's hopeful.
You interpret it as hopeful. How about you? You see it as hopeful or discouraged?
I'll go with discouraged.
You'll go with discouraging. This would be contrary to him. Well, it could actually, I think it was meant to be ambiguous. He uttering this to a king, a wicked king. He takes his son along and introduces his son in essence. And I think the name was supposed to make the king stop and think, well, now is this positive or is this negative? Only a remnant's going to come back? That means disaster. You know, if I said only a handful of you are going to pass this course, that's That would, most of you would take that to be very discouraging.
You say,
well, you can look at it the other way. Nobody's going to fail. Somebody's going to pass. Well, it was, has both those connotations. Now, the other son has the longest name in the Bible. You want a piece of trivia? You want to count the letters? There are 18 of them.
They're supposed to be, if I didn't misspell.
And you may have to work on pronouncing it. Mahershala Lahashbaz. But his dad called him Bud.
You say, where's the verse on that?
Well, that verse is on that one.
I think it's in the Dead Sea Scrolls or something. I don't know.
I can't imagine him, you know, he was probably graduating from high school before he learned to put his name on the paper. But anyway, his name again encapsulates the prophecy, and this time is kind of a negative prophecy, hastening to the spoil, hurrying to the prey, as he is illustrating the Assyrian soldiers racing here and there, grabbing up the plunder after a smashing victory. So what is he saying? The Assyrians are going to win a smashing victory. And so that's what Mahershala Lahashbaz's name means. Now there's a legend that Isaiah was twice married, based on 7:14, where it says, and the virgin shall conceive and bear a child. It takes something like that to be Isaiah's wife. I think that's the wrong interpretation of that verse, and I don't see any support for the theory that Isaiah married more than once. Now his home. He was a citizen, probably a native of the city of Jerusalem. He had constant access to the royal court, to the king's palace. Now, I want you to contrast him to another prophet who lived in the same time frame. They were both, I'm sure they knew each other. In fact, there are passages, there's one passage that's verbatim the same in the two books. So confident they got their heads together and preachers knew each other. But Micah, the minor prophet, whose book is in your Bible, came from a country. I say country, I mean the countryside. He was from a farming community a few miles from Jerusalem. But so you have Micah has been called the blue-collar preacher. I mean, he was the preacher who was rubbing elbows with the common working folks, you understand. Whereas Isaiah, most of his circle of ministry was in the royal court. And it's very interesting that the language of Hosea, it's not in your notes, I'm off the notes here, there's so much to tell you and so little time to do it in. A few years ago, I think I'm probably the only guy in the world that would undertake a project like this. I had an assistant that year. The school got real generous. Not this school, another school. Supplied me with a research assistant, which I'd never had before, and there were a lot of things I wanted to research that I didn't have time to research. And so I had this student, and he was doing this research for me, so many hours a week, so I put him on the trail of figuring out which of the prophets had the biggest vocabulary. Now, what does a large vocabulary tell you about something? Could be well educated, might indicate IQ, certainly education. I mean, one of the key things in measuring your intelligence and your knowledge is your vocabulary. And so I had him compare Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Jeremiah, three of each book, and actually list every Hebrew word. Now that's not as hard as it sounds like. Every different Hebrew word. He was to list. And so I could do a count and figure out which one had the biggest vocabulary. And you probably already guessed the answer. It was Isaiah by far. Now that doesn't mean he was necessarily smarter than Jeremiah or Ezekiel, but it might tell us something about the circles in which he ministered. You know, you can't preach to people who are well educated and well trained if you don't have a decent education yourself. If you're not familiar with literature, music, and history,
thing people come to Bible. I want to study the Bible.
That's all I want to study. I don't want to study all this other stuff.
Well, okay, I sympathize with that. You know, I struggled with that same issue when I was a student. But you limit your potential in ministry when you don't learn to speak English correctly, to write English correctly, to communicate with reference to things that maybe folks in your congregation, say they have college education, maybe some master's degrees in certain areas, and you don't know a thing about literature, a thing about history and the common books and things that are standard reference works and all that. They're not going to be interested in what you want to say. They're going to consider you an ignoramus, which is the plural of ignoramus. And if you're not familiar what that means, it means a dud. So Isaiah had the largest vocabulary by far of those three books. Now all three of those men had tremendous ministries, and all three were used by God. But Isaiah ministered in circles that I don't think Jeremiah could have ministered or even. Now, Jerusalem is the center of Isaiah's thoughts. He has a lot to say about it, as we will see as we go through the book. Now, the date of his ministry began in the year that King Uzziah, that great king I just talked to you about, died. Now, we can put a tag on that at about 740 B.C. I understand the dates, it's a scientific study to establish dates in biblical history. It's very technical, very hard. Very few people actually establish those dates themselves. I certainly haven't. I'm dependent upon people who have devoted their life to studying nothing more than chronology in the Bible. So these dates could be off a year or two one direction or the other, but 740 is generally the year given. In the reference works for the death of King Uzziah. Now, when did Isaiah die? Well, his life extended into the reign of King Manasseh. He doesn't mention Manasseh, as we pointed out to you last time in the opening verse, but we know that his life extended into the days of Manasseh, and so he must have died somewhere around about 685 before Christ. Now, this period of his life has been considered to be a period of unique significance in world history, not to mention biblical history. What's going on? Well, first of all, it's unique and important that Isaiah, this is easy to remember. I like things that are easy to remember. Isaiah lived almost exactly halfway between Moses and Christ. Now, that's something I think you can remember. I like to remember, for example, that we live on this side of the cross almost exactly the same number of years that Abraham lived on the other side of the cross. That's easy to remember. Okay? So, I like stuff like that. But anyways, halfway between Moses and Christ. But even more important than that little piece of trivia is the fact that you have rising to the surface the greatest empire that had been created upon the surface of the earth since the beginning of time. Now, there were later empires that were greater, of course, but this was the first of the great international empires, world empires. Egypt never really built a world empire, but Assyria did. And that's the country that is on the rise during this period. Assyria, not to be confused with Syria. Okay. Now, Isaiah's position, I think he probably was of noble birth. I'm not sure he was from the royal family, but maybe close to it. And I already have pointed out to you his easy access to the king. But here's another point that we know from Chronicles, and I'll give you the reference there in the notes, and for the benefit of the people on tape, I'll give the reference, 2 Chronicles 26, 22, that Isaiah was a court historiographer during the reigns of Jotham and Hezekiah. Now, what does
court historiographer would be the guy who's daily making records of what's going on in the reign of the king. It's his responsibility to keep the records and kind of a running history of the reign of the king. And that was what Isaiah did before God called him to be a prophet. So he already had literary experience, you might say, before God called him. And I think those are the kind of people God calls. God calls people who already have a certain amount of experience and already have a certain amount of ability in certain areas before he calls them to minister. Now his call, as I say, it came in the year that King Uzziah died, 740 B.C. Apparently, and I put a question mark by this, I'm not 100% sure myself, and no other commentary is either, but apparently he was in the temple in Jerusalem when he had this call experience. I put a question mark by that, and we'll see why when we get to chapter 6. In his vision, he sees a vision. Most of the prophets saw some sort of a vision when God called them to be a prophet. In his vision, he sees the Lord high and lifted up. Holy, holy, holy. He sees angelic beings that are called seraphim, some brand of angels. Whether you know it or not, but the Bible teaches that there are different types of angels. These were the six-winged variety. You have the four-winged variety and the six-winged variety and the non-winged variety. And so apparently there were angels, there are angels, even to this day, who have very different appearance. At least according to what the scripture seems to indicate. And he hears this choir, like it's actually like two choirs, singing back and forth in an antiphonal kind of a way. Holy, 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 emphasizing the holiness of God. Now Isaiah was about 20 years of age, roughly the age of some of you, most of you know, when he had this experience. Now here's the big question that pertains to chapter 6, and you will find good, honest commentators that have difference of opinion about it. Was this call experience where he sees the seraphim, hears them calling back and forth, and where one of them takes a coal and touches his lips and tells him now to go and preach as he's been cleansed of his sin? Is that his inaugural vision? In other words, is that the vision, is that the experience that launched his career as a prophet? Or, the other alternative, did he actually, some other experience that we know nothing of, set him to preaching, and then this experience comes along later? Why would it even be a question? Somebody, can you tell me from what we mentioned, why would it even be a question? Anybody see it? What chapter is this call experience recorded? In chapter 1, like Jeremiah and Ezekiel? No, it's in chapter 6. So if this is his initial, inaugural, launch pad vision, what's it doing in chapter 6? Can anybody, we will talk about that when we get there, but for the preliminary, as a preliminary discussion here, can anybody suggest a reason why his call vision may be put in chapter 6, if it is his call vision? Let's say it was, just for the sake of the argument. Why might he put it in chapter 6 instead of chapter 1?
Yes, John.
Well, obviously, if it is his call vision, then the book is not in chronological order, but you see, you're sidestepping my question and you're pushing it back a little. My question is, why didn't he put it first? It's obviously not be in chronological order if it's not in chapter 1. It should be in chapter 1 if it's called vision. But can anybody think of a legitimate reason why he will leave it until chapter 6? Well, okay, that's something for you to ponder until we get there. We'll be there in a few sessions. I'll let you ponder that question. Now, let's talk about his prophetic career. We're still going right down the line here. His ministry was one of the longer ones, and it's not the longest by any means, but is one of the longer prophetic ministries in the Bible. It was 50 plus years, as best I can figure it out. And I've broken his 50 years down into some stages. And I'm not really sure there's where you would find this material anywhere else, but let's point out these stages of his ministry. Number one, the year 740 to 734, so about 5 years there, what I call his early years. Now this is where he came into prominence for the first time and came on the stage. It was during that Syro-Edomitic invasion that we listed as one of the crises. It was that crisis that brought Isaiah into the public eye for the first time. Then years 734 to 716, I call the withdrawal years, where he doesn't really have much to say. In fact, he tells us in chapter 8 he's going to keep silent for a while. And so he appears to withdraw from the public limelight for those years. Then in 716, what I call the middle years, for about, 11 years, this is the reign of Hezekiah. He begins to speak out again because he's got a good king on the throne, and they're good friends. Hezekiah and Isaiah are good buddies. And so it's during this period of time that Isaiah goes around stripped of his sackcloth and sandals, said to be naked. Now, I had a letter come from a lady here in the state a few years ago. She was all upset because she read an article somewhere in some local newspaper that said that Isaiah went around preaching naked. And she wanted to know if that was true or not. Well, it's what the scripture said. But naked in the scripture does not mean nude. It simply means without the outer garment, without the main garment that you would normally wear in public, a long road type thing. So it doesn't mean in the nuns of Hunger, as we used to say in the Smith household. That's Hindi. Now you know a little Hindi in on, you know, throw a little Hebrew later on. That's Hindi. Jessica, you use that Hindu phrase in your home. Did that make it to your level? It did. Okay, it was handed down another generation. So, okay. Now you know Hindi. Okay. Well, I don't know how useful it is, but maybe. Then in the years 705 to 701, I call that the climactic years of Isaiah's ministry. Now, you see, 701, if you're sharp today, you realize that was the year when Sennacherib invaded Judah and just about swallowed up Judah. As he came like a flood right up to the neck. You know, Jerusalem was treading water, and the water was pretty deep. And that was 701. So the years leading up to 701, that's when Isaiah's ministry really hit its stride. That's when he really came on powerful. And so then, after 701, we don't have any more preaching from Isaiah. And I call this his literary years, when he actually does his writing. Now, the last dated event in Isaiah is this invasion by Sennacherib in 701. That's the last dated event in the book. However, he does mention an Assyrian king that lived after 701, so we know he lived after that for a while. And there is a verse over in Chronicles that suggests that he may have outlived Hezekiah, and putting all that together is why I suggested earlier that he must have died somewhere about 685 B.C. So that period from 701 to 685, what would that be? Roughly 15 years, is the period when he wrote those last chapters of his book, the 27 chapters that are looking beyond the Assyrian issue. And those chapters, I think, were written during that time frame. But he was primarily working on literary contribution rather than preaching. Now, symbolic actions. Now, if we were in Jeremiah class or Ezekiel, those are some of the most exciting things those prophets did. They did all kinds of weird things, which are fascinating to study. And you just wonder if a preacher tried that kind of stuff today, how long you'd last.
my guess is not long. But Isaiah, again, this may be because of the audience to which he preached, but he was much more dignified, let's put it that way, in his ministry, and there are only two recorded symbolic actions that he performed. So, one is this going around without this outer robe, by the way, and we'll talk about what that means later on.
Right? Well, right now, just learn that that was what he did. We'll learn why he did it later, okay?
I don't want to put everything off to later, but my purpose today is to kind of give you an introduction to his life. The second symbolic act was when he put a cake of figs on this boil that was about to kill King Hezekiah. And I take it to be a symbolic act, and I've had students that have questioned that over the years. That's fine. You're free to have your own opinion. Some have tried to go to the internet and come with all bundles of evidence that figs have drawing power, you know, it sucks the poison out of this boil, and I'm sure figs do. I don't question that at all, but if this boil was going to kill Hezekiah, and all Isaiah did was put a common remedy on that boil, then we better go to our cancer doctors with a bunch of figs. And, you know, send them a box of Fig Newtons or something. Tell them to work on the properties of faith. Now, I don't think it was ordinary healing that was taking place. I think it was a symbolic action that from this moment, God will begin to heal you. And 3 days later, it wasn't one of the instantaneous miracles of the Bible. Like so many miracles where lame people jumped up and dead people rose up and, you know, crippled people jumped and on you. This was a miracle that began and was completed over a 3-day process when finally Hezekiah was restored to his natural health. Two miracles. Not very many miracles. You know, the interesting thing about the prophets that wrote books in the Bible, very few of them did miracles or had miracles connected with their name. Now, I understand that somebody's going to get technical on it. Well, God did a miracle. Well, you know, God did a lot of miracles through Elijah and Elisha back in the book of Kings, but they didn't write any books in the Bible. The prophets who wrote books in the Bible, very, very few. In fact, I can't think of any except these two right here that are attributed to Isaiah. One is the healing, the miraculous healing. I think it was miraculous. Healing of King Hezekiah over a 3-day period. And the second was a sign that was given to King Hezekiah of a shadow going back on a sundial. Now, Bible days, they told time by fixing what was called a sun, well, we call it today a sundial, I guess. What it amounted to was a series of steps, I don't know how many. And when the sun came up, here's the sun, great artwork. When the sun came up in the morning, of course, these steps on this side would be lit up, and as it went across the horizon, the shadow would gradually come up these steps, and each step was designed to represent so much passage of time. That's the way they marked time. So the official sundial of the royal court was right outside the window of the palace, and the king could look out there and see what time it was. And so Isaiah came to Hezekiah and said, Hezekiah was a little skeptical of what you're going to recover from this death illness or not. And Isaiah said, well, just look out there at your sundial and tell me, will you want the Lord to make the shadow to go back 10 steps, or do you want him to make the shadow go forward 10 steps? And Isaiah said, make it go back. He thought that was a greater miracle for some reason. And God did. And so that's the other miracle attached or connected to the ministry of Isaiah. Now, I already told you about his death. And supposedly, according to very early legend, sawn asunder during the days of King Manasseh. And I've already told you that there may be a reference to that in Hebrews 11:37. Now, I'm not going to take time to go over all these points concerning the character of Isaiah that I've gleaned from the pulpit commentary. I think these are excellent statements of the character of the man as it's revealed in his writing. But notice the summary statement at the end, which I think is some of the greatest lines ever written about Isaiah. Let's just go over it, so I know you're not reading it, but I don't read it to you.
Never perhaps has there been another prophet like Isaiah who stood with his head in the clouds and his feet on the solid earth, with his heart in the things of eternity and with his mouth and hands in the things of time, with his spirit in the eternal counsel of God and his body in a very definite moment of history. I like that statement. I think that I wish I could write things like that. That just captures what Isaiah is all about. Now, some of his associates, we've already mentioned Micah. Add to that the same general time frame as Isaiah, Hosea, in the northern kingdom. Now, they were not in the same kingdom, so I don't imagine that they knew each other. They might have known of each other, but I don't know that they actually knew each other because they were working in different environments. Amos, now that's another, he was in the same general time frame. Amos was born just a few miles south of Jerusalem, but he did most of his preaching up north. Did he know Isaiah? Did they have any relationship? Again, I don't know that we can say one way or the other. Now, I collect personal designations for prophets out of books. If you ever come across a good juicy one for a prophet, write it down for me. Who gave it, you give it to me, I like to add it to my collection. And I'm not going to go over these 26 designations, let me just highlight four of them. Number one, Isaiah, Prince of the Prophets. I like that. I think you are studying what many scholars believe is the greatest of the biblical prophets, because of the things he says and the way he says it. You can be the judge of that later, but that's the opinion of many people. Number nine, I would highlight the great central prophet. And I've already explained why Isaiah is called the central prophet, because he lived exactly halfway between Moses and Christ. Number 14, the gospel prophet, highlights the point that Isaiah has so much to say in terms of predicting the coming of Christ. And number 19, the St. Paul of the Old Testament, is suggested by the fact that Isaiah emphasizes so much faith, as Paul did in the New Testament. Faith is the way of deliverance from attack, from judgment. Now, in terms of the book of Isaiah, and this is where our study is going to get a little hairy, frankly, the liberals, the non-believers, have gotten into the act, as they have on almost every book of the Bible. And I don't want to waste a lot of time on it, except I do think you need to be informed, at least in a broad sense, so that you kind of know when you read in a book and they refer to some of these things, you'll know what it's talking about. So let me just highlight it without trying to get into a lot of detail, because my philosophy of Bible teaching is that at the undergraduate level, you should study the Bible. And if you want to go on to seminary, some of you will, you can study what men have said about the Bible. Now, that's a different thing. Studying the Bible is one thing. Studying what men have said about the Bible is a different thing. Both important, but the first is far more. Now, let me kind of boil this down. First of all, this modern critical view. By modern critical view, we mean people that do not accept the Bible for what it claims to be. We call them liberals, or modernists, or biblical critics. And about way back in the 1780s, a liberal scholar by the name of Eichhorn decided that the last 27 chapters of Isaiah could not have been written by the Isaiah who wrote the first 39 chapters. And I'll explain the reasons why they came up with that idea in just a moment. So he split those chapters away, not literally, but in treating the book of Isaiah, he would treat Isaiah up to chapter 39, and then this other material, he gave it a name, which is still with us today, called Deutero-Isaiah. Isn't that impressive? Now, Deutero simply means second. So who was this dude who wrote the great... Everybody admits that chapter 40 through 66 of Isaiah are the greatest chapters in the Old Testament. And yet, who wrote them? According to the critics, we don't know. We don't know. Now, moving on from there, a fellow named Rosenmuller came along and said, now, wait a minute. Well, we've got chapters 40 through 66 out here by Deutero. But then Rosenmuller came along and he said, well, I find material in chapters 1 through 39 that's very similar to chapters 40 through 66. Now, in my mind, that would say what? What would that tell you if you find material here that is like material here? What? Same writer! That's the way my mind thinks. But that's not the way their mind thinks. Their mind says, whoa, wait a minute here. These chapters over here, certain of these chapters, they fit better in the environment. Here's what they assigned this Deutero thing to 150 years after Isaiah. And then they take about 12 more chapters out of this and they put it over here in Deutero Isaiah. Now, as time went on, so you've got Deutero Isaiah. You've got 27 chapters plus 12 from over here. Deutero Isaiah is growing, don't you see? And then somebody said, now wait a minute. Doom said that the chapters 55 through 66 could not be by the same author who wrote 40 through 66. Well, who wrote those chapters? Well, Trito Isaiah, which means third Isaiah. So now we have three Isaiah. Okay? And eventually they kept creating new Isaiahs. Based on what? An analysis of the text, thinking that they discovered differences of vocabulary or differences of style or differences of emphasis. This must indicate different writers. And so by the time that I started through my PhD program, they were talking about this great and wonderful book of Isaiah. They were dubbing it the garbage can of prophecy. Literally called it the garbage can of prophecy. And the idea was that anybody who was a crackpot and thought he was a prophet and had something to say would throw it in the garbage can, and all got hodgepodge together, and that's all there was about it. So when I went through my doctoral program, I took a course called Isaiah 1. And we studied some selected chapters here. Next quarter, we studied Isaiah 2, which was selected chapters here. And then I had a third quarter, Isaiah 3. Then I had a fourth quarter called Apocalyptic Isaiah, Messianic Isaiah, and finally at the last quarter in the series was the rest of Isaiah. We finally got to the bottom of the garbage can, don't you see? Can you imagine chopping up a biblical book, or any book, in that fashion and treating it in that way? Now, why do they deny the unity of the book of Isaiah? What's behind it? What's driving it? And the basic assumption, the a priori assumption of the biblical critics is that prophecy is impossible. Not even God knows the future. Well, I can't buy into that. And if you take that position that prophecy is impossible, so what are you going to do with the prophecies in the text? You come up with, somebody tell me what you do. Your position is there is no such thing as prophecy, and you come to a prophecy that says that God is going to raise up Cyrus to deliver his people from Babylon. What are you going to do with that if Cyrus hasn't been born for 150 years? What are you going to do with that? Well, you're not going to discard it, you're going to redate it. So every so-called prediction was written after the fact. It would be like me sitting down and predicting the hurricane yesterday. That tremendous
day of wind and rain that we all experienced. I got a couple of drops on my car in Orlando. It's about all we got. Did y'all get anything down here? What's that? Anyway, I could predict that inerrantly at this point. In fact, that's all I have. And thus saith the Lord, there shall be a hurricane in Kissimmee on August 23rd. A hurricane will go through Kissimmee. Why? Put that down, man. Accurate prophecy, except the problem is it's already happened. You know, I could predict who won the pennant last year in baseball. I can predict who won the Super Bowl last year. I can predict almost anything that's already happened. I know about it. And that's what they claim the biblical writers did. So basically, when they come to the biblical text and there's a prediction, instead of accepting that as a marvelous example of God's foreknowledge of the future, they take it as evidence that that part of the text at least could not possibly have been written back here in the days of Isaiah in the 700s, when, for example, King Cyrus does not. They come to, I don't know what page it is, where it says the improbabilities of the negative position. Are you with me? I'm skipping some material here. Yeah, I just don't want to waste time on it. It's boring. But look at these improbabilities. Number one, it's improbable that the author of chapter 43:56, the greatest act in the Old Testament, left neither natural in the traditions of his people. To me, that's improbable. It's even more improbable that a group of anonymous oracles should get passed off to those of Isaiah. And if you want to multiply mathematically the improbabilities, then consider the last improbability of the critical condition. It is improbable that these two discord sets of material, here and here, got so intermingled and intertwined over time that it takes a PhD and an expert in Hebrew to sort it all out. To me, that was one improbability on top of another, till the point is that, in my view, that the negative position regarding the book of Isaiah is just totally unreasonable. And I'm happy to report, and so much in my long career, that I can report to you happily that the critics are starting to put the book of Isaiah back together. They're coming towards us in our position. When I was in Bible college where you are, we had the Deuteronomy and the Trito, the Anonymous Isaiah, and the Messianic Isaiah, and the Apocalyptic Isaiah, and all these Isaiahs, and that's what things say. But today, they're giving up that nonsense. A lot of them. They're just still hanging on to parts of it. And you're still reading the commentary, Deuteronomy Isaiah. So when they read Deuteronomy Isaiah, you're going to think, what chapter? 46. So if you're writing your term paper and you're using a source that talks about Deuteronomy Isaiah, Treatise Isaiah, and all that baloney, you probably would be wise to put that down and get a commentary that does not accept that position. It's going to lead you down the wrong trail. So that's why I'm taking time to go over this with you. Watch out for Deuteronomy. Okay. Now, what is the evidence that the book of Isaiah is all one book? Well, external evidence. Well, of course, tradition knows of only one prophet named Isaiah. The Septuagint. LXX, abbreviation for the Septuagint. It's Roman numeral 70 because it was translated by 70 scholars. The Septuagint, translated 250 years before Christ, gives the entire content of the book of Isaiah without any break or indication of a second document in there. Ben Sira, or Ecclesiasticus, it's also called, one of the few datable books between the Old and New Testament. It speaks only of Isaiah, nothing more than that. The Haftarahs were read in the Jewish synagogues from the prophets, do not distinguish between the sections of the book as if they were by different authors. Josephus cites the disputed Cyrus passage. He said that passage was uttered 140 years before Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple, which means it was a genuine prediction.
In the Nazareth synagogue, Jesus got up and read from the latter half of Isaiah, what the critics call Deutero-Isaiah, and he said, "Isaiah said this." And to me, that's settled right there, don't you think? If Christ reads these chapters and says that Isaiah wrote it, that settles for me as a believer. And you can go on down the list, the other arguments that I make. Come over to the internal evidence for the unity of the book. Of course, you have the heading. And normally when you pick up a book and it says somebody wrote the book, you take that to be an accurate statement unless there is overwhelming evidence to the contrary. And in this case, the book of Isaiah, I would argue the evidence is far from overwhelming. The manuscripts of Isaiah, Hebrew manuscripts, no distinction between, no gap. When they found the Dead Sea Scrolls of Isaiah, they found a couple of complete scrolls of Isaiah. They were anxious, oh, wow, this is the earliest copy of Isaiah.
Will there be a break at the end of chapter 39?
There was. And then you get the philological evidence, and the circle of ideas simply means that in all sections of the book you find some odd spellings. You know, it's like, you know, people spell something in an odd way that carries through all of their writings. Or if they're talking about certain ideas, like you find all the way through the book, the Holy One of Israel, that's Isaiah's favorite name for God, the Holy One of Israel, based on that call experience, where heard the seraphim say, "Holy, holy, holy." The idea of a highway that people will walk on in the future, common to both sides of the book. Zion, the pangs of a woman in travail, one of the favorite figures of speech used throughout the book of Isaiah. Now, these kinds of things tend to tie the book together and argue that it's one book by one author. Now, yes, there are some different emphases in different parts of the book. Well, how can you account for that? How could you account for a different emphasis by the same writer in his book? Yes?
Were there other periods of time that
he was going to be specific? Exactly. And the material he wrote after 701, it no longer talks about these things. Well, why should it? They've been with. They're no longer a problem. They're no longer in the picture. So he's talking about something else down the road. It's a new environment. Makes sense, doesn't it? And that would explain some of the differences of vocabulary and some of the differences that the critics point out. Now, in terms of the style and diction of the book of Isaiah, as we highlight some other things here, I'm not going to go over this. But suffice it to say that for many of the biblical scholars regard Isaiah as the most eloquent of the biblical prophets. The techniques that he uses in writing his book are depending more upon various writers and have listed a number of marks of his writing style. I don't want to spend time on that in class. Reasons for studying the book of Isaiah, I list five of them. Intrinsic grandeur, it's simply great literature. Sublime revelations of God. I remember a few years ago teaching a class where I had a graduate of the University of Kentucky. She hadn't had a lot of Bible training. She had a lot of brainwashing by non-believing professors. And she came to graduate school. She already had her bachelor's degree. And we were going through Isaiah. And right out of class, right in the middle of the lecture, she just burst in one day. And she just expressed amazement. She said, "I never knew great God was." And she interrupted the whole class to make that statement right in the middle of one of the great texts in Isaiah. It just struck her, and it will strike you too. Some of the greatest texts about God and His nature and His abilities will be found when we get to the chapters 40 through 66. Wonderful, wonderful material. The evangelical character of the book, that is, its concern for bringing the lost to the Lord. Evidential value, the prophecies that are in the book help to nail down the identity of Jesus Christ, for example. And then just plain simple devotional help that will really inspire your soul. "They shall mount up with wings like eagles." You're going to be memorizing that verse.
and the implications of those who wait upon the Lord will have strength to deal with all of life's problems. So all of these reasons are reasons that I think we should have a course in Isaiah. Now, in terms of the Dead Sea Scrolls, here's the situation. Let me get rid of my son up here. Before 1947, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, our circumstances were lived. Our oldest copy of Isaiah came from 850 A.D. The oldest copy of the book of Isaiah that we had in our possession. Now, 1947, I don't know your parents. When were your parents born?
Was that before 47?
No. How about your grandpas? Any of you have grandpas or grandmas that are good old, faithful, loyal Christians? Well, in the days of your grandparents, if not your parents, all we had in the book of Isaiah was a manuscript that was that dated only to 850 AD. Now think about the truth. You're going to say what? How about a skeptic out there? Knowing that fact, a skeptic might say, what? How do you know what?
How do you know it's real?
No, that's not what they're going to ask.
How do you?
They ask you this all the time, but they're stupid. They don't know the facts.
Don't say that to George. You know, I should say they're idiots. They're not stupid. Now, ignorance is correct, but stupid is correct. Okay?
They're ignorant. They don't know the facts. And people ask you this question all the time. What's the biggest question of a skeptic? You go out and see some of your buddies in high school. They're going to ask you a question about the Bible. Here's the Bible tells you. How do you know somebody didn't change the Bible? How do you know that what we have today in our Bible is what was actually written by those people back then? Now that's a question born out of ignorance, because there's no doubt about it. If you know the facts in terms of the manuscript evidence and the New Testament, the Old Testament, and so forth and so on. But that's not even a matter of faith. I mean, that's just a matter of fact that we have in our possession the words of Paul and John and Isaiah and Jeremiah and all the rest of it. But in 1947, I don't know how your grandparents would have answered that question. Because that's a big gap between 800 years before Christ and 800 years after Christ. I wasn't a whiz-banging man, but that sounds like 1600 years. And over 1600 years, it may well be that somebody could have changed it, right? And that was the circumstance that believers had to face before 1947. Now after 1947, think of this. Our oldest Isaiah manuscript now dates to 150 B.C. So we've chopped off, it's about basically 1,000 years older. Older than what we had in 1947. So we take this oldest Dead Sea Scroll from 150 years before Christ, compare it with this 850 A.D. scroll of the same book, and look at it word for word, and guess what happens? The Dead Sea Isaiah scroll is 1,000 years older than the next oldest manuscript, but they were virtually identical. The scholars thought they were going to find all kinds of difference. I think they found 8 minor spelling differences in the entire 66 chapters of Isaiah. Unbelievable. So when somebody says to you, how do you know they didn't change the Bible? Well, this is evidence, pretty good evidence, I think. Bring the evidence to the court of human reason and say, what do you make of this? The two manuscripts are virtually identical over 1,000 years. They copied it very, very carefully. Now, the chronology of the book,
I think probably the book is in essentially, is primarily in chronological order, with the exception we already noted in chapter 6. And I'm asking you to ponder between now and the time we get to chapter 6 why Isaiah may have had reason to put that chapter where he did, rather than in chapter 1, where he could have been. Now, within certain sections of the book, for example, where we have a collection of messages directed toward foreign nations, there might be some dispute about the exact chronology within sections. But the sections of Isaiah, I think, are primarily in order. Now, I want you to study carefully the chart that's there in your syllabus and the structure of Isaiah. I want you to see this chart, basically memorize it, because it's the overall structure of the book. And those first 39 chapters have to be labeled as part one of the book. In those first 39 chapters, we find the main enemy is Assyria, and we find that it deals with the times of Ahaz and Hezekiah. We find numerous headings and dates. We find that Isaiah is mostly denouncing the people of Judah. And we see the Messiah presented in this section as the great ruler of the future. Now, I'm going to talk more about this in a moment, so just let it sink in. I'll explain what I mean about it in a moment. Now, beginning in chapter 40, this is chapters 1 through 35, here, beginning in chapter 40, the main enemy is no longer Syria, it's Babylon. As I said a moment ago, the Assyrian threat is over. He deals with the time of the Babylonian captivity. He's projected into the future. He knows it's going to happen. He's predicted it. And he begins to have prophecies that will be of interest to the people when they experience that event. There are no subdivisions that are obvious in those chapters. These chapters, these last 27 chapters, are chiefly consoling and not denouncing. And the Messiah is presented not as ruler, but as redeemer in the last part of the book of Isaiah. Now let me show you, I've already indicated to you that I like simple ways to remember. How many books are in the Old Testament? Well, they're not speaking once. My little mnemonic device is not going to be particularly valuable to you unless you know how many books are on the Old Testament. How many are there? 39. How many books are in the New Testament? 27. There are 27 chapters here. I'm counting the historical collecting in 39 chapters here. Those first 39 chapters are primarily negative. Primarily, not entirely, like the Old Testament, judgment, God's wrath. The 27 chapters that follow are primarily full of hope, positive, not entirely, but much of it, like the New Testament, which is much more positive than the Old Testament. Now I'm still on this chart, but let me show it to you from a little different perspective to show you what this historical connecting link is all about. What we have in Isaiah is something like this. Chart up here, so what I'm trying to show you, the historical connecting link is four chapters. 36 and 37 are the climax of everything that Isaiah said in the first 35 chapters about Assyria. The Assyrians have come. The Assyrian threat has come up to the neck, just like Isaiah said it would. Chapters 38 and 39 are looking toward these last chapters where he predicts that Babylon is going to be the threat of the future, not Assyria. God is going to take care of Assyria, but Babylon will be the threat of the future that will destroy Jerusalem. And those two chapters look forward to all of the hope and the expectation that he says in chapters 40 through 66. Now, looking at that, brethren, what would you say, what conclusion would you come to about the arrangement of the book of Isaiah? Is it haphazard? Is it random? Is it a garbage can into which people just threw things? Or what's the other alternative? What would you conclude about this book based upon this evidence? It's what?
From the ledger.
Well, yeah, that's not exactly what I'm looking for. Who has no observation? What's the opposite of randomly thrown together? What?
Strategically organized? Structured?
Yeah. Well planned.
Okay.
So far from being the garbage can of prophecy, here's a book that is laid out once you understand what he's doing.
It really makes sense the way it's laid out. Now, let me joke. This is the clincher.
How do we know that this organization was intentional on the part of the author and not something that Doc Smith has cooked up in his own brain?
How do we know it's not that something Isaiah intended for the good and not something that some professor somewhere or writer or commentary has simply discovered?
Here's the answer. These two chapters, 36 and 37, chronologically actually follow 38 and 39 in actual chronology. So why has Isaiah flip-flopped them? The only thing you can conclude is it has to be deliberate. And why is it deliberate? To make the point that this period is now over and the Babylonian period, which he predicts in 38 and 39, lies ahead. And to make the book tell that story, he has flip-flopped these two chapters actually chronologically would come to you. But because they actually finish up this material, he puts them first. Now that suggests to me that this writer has planned this book very carefully. And that it would be very hazardous on our part to jump in and assume that he didn't know what he was talking about. A couple of more points to finish up here in our last couple of minutes. Isaiah in the New Testament. 47 chapters from Isaiah are either quoted directly or distinctly alluded to in the New Testament. 47 out of 66 chapters. 12 chapters are quoted where Isaiah specifically is named in the New Testament. The book of Isaiah is referred to more than 400 times in the New Testament. Along with Psalms, Isaiah is the most popular book in the New Testament. Is there any wonder why we as New Testament Christians ought to be especially concerned about this above all other prophetic books? It's because of the influence that it had on the New Testament. Every section of New Testament books quotes from Isaiah except in the pastoral epistles of Paul. Now the theme of the book, as I've already hinted, is salvation by faith. That's the theme that is carried out throughout this book. Some have said this book illustrates the book of Romans. So if you want to break the book down into two, just look at it as a two-fold book. Try this outline by Mark, chapters 1 through 39, judgment from God, equivalent to the 39 books of the Old Testament. Chapters 40 through 66, comfort from God, equivalent to the 27 books of the New Testament in number of chapters. Any questions on what we've talked about today? Anything you're not clear about, I can make clearer to you.